Keep away from Junk Food Cast unless you're tired of sulking. They'll talk forgotten movies past, some with Macaulay Culkin.
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Hello, transgressors, and welcome to another fairy tale episode of Junk Food Cinema right here on filmschoolrejects.com. Dot pumpkins. This is
okay. That's where we are.
There it is.
Which fucking episode are we doing?
It's all just nebulous. You have no idea what's going on, where stuff is going to end up, where the content is going to fall. This is what happens when we record like four episodes all together at once. This is just what happens.
It's what happens when somebody has a kid and somebody overbooks themselves on writing gigs.
And when you put them together, it's the worst sitcom you've ever watched.
It would be a pretty bad sitcom.
It's still better than Big Bang Theory. This is the cult and exploitation film cast. So good, it just has to be fattening. It's at least as good as queso-flavored Ruffles. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a screenwriter, novelist, lieutenant of Megaforce, someone who probably has never pissed off a witch in the woods, but we can't prove it. We have no evidence to the contrary, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi. Oh, I've definitely pissed off witches in the woods.
Of course you have. Of course you have.
Holly.
Okay. I have so many things to say just about the name of Lance Henriksen's character in this movie. But first, I have to, of course, do the plug. And the plug, of course, is that Cargill has a book out right now.
Oh, we're still doing that. Yeah. I have a book.
Is it still a book?
It's still a book. It's called Sea of Rust. You can find it wherever you buy books. There's an audiobook version of it you can get from Audible or wherever you get your audiobooks. You can get hardcover here in the United States. You can get the paperback over in the UK. And, yeah. It is around.
Do you know what they call Sea of Rust in Europe? America book. Hey, if you want to, if you're done for the day and you want to spend your afternoon doing something at least as entertaining as eating queso-flavored Russells?
Okay. Yeah, Mr. Crow would like to have a conversation with you.
I'll tell you what it is. I saw Virtuosity for the first time last weekend.
You're kidding me. For the first time,
and I fucking loved it.
All right, well, we got to do that.
I
love Virtuosity. I saw that in a theater. Fucking love Virtuosity.
I want to do a whole month on the internet is whatever we want it to be, which is like this great spate of movies from the mid-90s. We already covered one of them, probably the king of that, which is Hackers. And then Virtuosity is another in that great tradition of, we don't know what the fuck the internet is, but we're going to pretend we do.
Oh,
it's this, right?
It's kind of like the net.
It's kind of like, oh my God, yes. So much to unpack, including...
So much Russell.
Queso-flavored Russell. That's a pretty good title for that month. Anyway, if you would like to hear more of our past themed months and episodes not exactly like, but not entirely dissimilar to queso-flavored Russell, you can check out our entire back catalog on iTunes, as well as on Blog Talk Radio, which is our host and our home. Thank you very much, Blog Talk Radio. And you can also find us on Twitter, at Junk Food Cinema, and you can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like this show, if you can't get enough of it, if you take one bite and you're like, that's an overpowering junk food taste, but I just have to have another, Patreon.com/JunkFoodCinema is a great way to support the show and make sure that we keep the lights on here at Junk Food HQ. Keep us in Sabritas for all of the days to come. That is your mission, and we appreciate you taking on that holy charge. Speaking of holy charges, we are still in Schlocktober, and as Cargill pointed out to me as we started recording, we enter into the back end of an unexpected, unintentional theme of going into the woods and getting fucked up. And this
kind of a redneck horror.
Redneck horror month, and we are continuing redneck horror month with a true classic, I feel.
I like to think of it as a touch of class in a sea of trash.
There's a slogan for our t-shirt right there.
So it's, yeah, no, the thing about this movie is that this is a very classy, very classically structured and put together horror film amid a period when that wasn't hip. Like, at this point, when this movie came out, as we've talked about, if you know, longtime listeners know we've talked about this many times, that horror took a very strange turn in 1986 and went meta and started getting goofy and started, you know, it turned into splatter and it was fun splatter, not hard splatter. And so we talked about another film that came out in this era, Hellraiser, which was aiming for that classic, but was very sleazy, you know, in its own way, that it was very much, you know, it was very sexually driven. It was very weird, but it also had some really great ideas to it. And it was playing with, you know, other realms and hell and all of these great ideas that made it well worth discussing. Hellraiser is, Pumpkinhead is a classic horror story. It is a monster story. It is, I think it is more akin to The Legend of Sleepy Hollow than I feel it has anything to do with the horror going on in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
This is a morality play. This is a story about something awful happening and then using the monster as an extension of what's wrong with humanity rather than just as an antagonist.
Well, very much in the realm of the Grimm's Brothers fairy tales, which I feel like is why this movie so often gets compared to fairy tales. And of course, this is the part where I have to say it and give a little pause for Meryl so we can drop in that trailer. We're talking this week about Pumpkinhead.
Afraid raising the dead ain't within my power.
Looking for an old woman. She lives somewhere in the mountains hereabouts. All she can do is take you straight to hell. You go home and you bury your boy. Some folks say is how she's got powers.
Who are you?
Ed Harley.
What do you want, Ed Harley? Say it. You're looking for vengeance. Vengeance. Say it. There's no graveyard way back deep in them woods. The thing you're looking for is in there.
It was an accident.
So, yeah, it is very much a morality play, which a lot of fairy tales are. There's a lesson. It's a fable, I guess, more than a morality or than a fairy tale, because fairy tales don't always have a very clear-cut moral, whereas a fable is all about the moral.
Yeah, although it does kind of hit all the points of a fairy tale.
True story. True story.
We've got a demon. We've got a witch in the woods. We've got a person who makes a terrible mistake. We've got children in peril. Like, we've got all of the hallmarks of a fairy tale in this movie.
Now, the plot of this movie, if you haven't seen it, which I strongly recommend you fix that ASAP.
And it's super easy to find. It's on three different streaming services for free right now, yeah, including Amazon Prime. You can rent it anywhere else. But before we go any further, before we even talk about the plot, this movie was directed by Stan fucking Winston.
Directed by Stan Winston, one of the absolute kings of practical effects. I mean, revered. This is a man whose name is revered in all, not just horror circles, but in cinemaphile circles. Like, if you are a cinephile, you know the name Stan Winston, and you genuflect at its utterance, because yeah, this is the man who created some of the greatest and most lasting, iconic images in film. Do we need to run down his catalog? Do we need to talk about
Because
the Xenomorphs?
It's kind of what we do for a living.
Oh, I guess that's true. We could talk about the Xenomorphs and Alien. We could talk about the Terminator robots. We can talk about the working on Predator. We can talk about Jesus Christ. Like, just that alone, I could stop right there. And
yeah, this is the guy who created the robots in the Terminator movies. This is the guy who created the practical effects of the Xenomorphs, even though they were designed by somebody else. He did an unreal amount of films in the makeup department. Edward Scissorhands. He worked on early stuff like Friday the 13th Part 2.
Monster Squad.
Yep. Something Wicked This Way Comes. Jesus. That's a future episode that we keep saying we need to do. Edward Scissorhands.
Fucking Small Soldiers with Joe Dante. You know, he did the animatronic and creature effects on Galaxy Quest. Like, fucking name it, man. Like, yeah, this guy's been all up and down.
Yeah,
Iron Man. Fucking Iron Man. Stan Winston worked on goddamn Iron Man, for crying out loud.
Yeah. And, you know, just doing special and did stuff all the way up till his death.
Yeah.
Now, the thing about Stan Winston is that he also directed.
He did, although not a lot.
No.
As it turns out.
No, he did not. But he made one film that is a perfect horror film, and that is Pumpkinhead.
I want to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, Cargill, I think the only movie, the only full-length feature film he directed was Pumpkinhead. I think the other things he directed, unless I'm mistaken, are music videos. He did Guns N' Roses, You Could Be Mine.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is a song in the Terminator 2 soundtrack. And then he did Michael Jackson's Ghosts, which was
was always under the impression that A Gnome Named Norm was a feature-length movie.
Oh, was it? Okay, so maybe there's a possibility
I might
it was
be
two.
Wrong. Yeah, no, it's 84 minutes long, yeah.
Okay, so feature-length films, one of which, right out of the gate, like, I want to be a director. I'm going to make a perfect horror film in Pumpkinhead.
And then would go on to make, produce and put together a film called Wrong Turn.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another really great horror film. Again, dealing with the same aesthetic. Here's a guy who did a lot of fucking science fiction stuff that he's best known for. And then when he made his own stuff, kept taking us out to the woods for horror. And I find that really fascinating about him. But of course, if not for Stan Winston, we wouldn't have Wrong Turn. And without Wrong Turn, we wouldn't have Wrong Turn 2. And we might not have Joe Lynch.
Okay, like, now, correct me, remind me, refresh my memory. Joe Lynch is on a podcast called...
It's a Movie Crib!
Yeah, that one. That's
yeah,
the
that one.
One.
So, but yeah, so Stan Winston did some amazing, amazing stuff, but this is what I love Stan Winston most for, and this is why I'm so glad we're talking Pumpkinhead. Because this is a movie, in fact, I was rewatching it with my wife last night, and she'd already seen it. And we watched it like 20 years ago when we first got together, and I was like, you've never seen Pumpkinhead? I have to show you Pumpkinhead! And she was, while we were watching it, she's like, I remember liking this movie, but I didn't realize how good this movie is.
Yeah.
Like, this is so much better than I remember it.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing I think about Pumpkinhead, is Pumpkinhead gets lumped in with all of this splatter from the 80s, and it isn't splatter. In fact, for a makeup effects director, there are very few gory kills. In fact, there's really not much gore to it, despite the body count.
Shocking.
The horror here is entirely in the amazing fucking creature design.
Oh, it just haunting how good and how well designed and how not only how well designed the monster is and how great the makeup is, but the way that Stan Winston frames shots to give every bit of clout and every bit of full impact to that creature. Like the scene where he's standing in the doorway of an old abandoned, dilapidated church, and it's just like this shadowy blue backdrop. It's just, it's perfect. It's a perfect fucking shot.
Almost.
One perfect shot. Where is that fucking frame? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, actually, that scene bothers me just a little bit.
Because it's too perfect?
No. There's a small little movie-making thing in it that's... We keep cutting to that shot, and that shot looks really badass. And then we cut back to the people looking at Pumpkinhead, and there's these lights flashing on him. And then we cut back, and there's no fucking lights flashing in that shot. And then we cut back, and the lights flashing on him again, because every time Pumpkinhead shows up, there's some weird kind of lighting effect going on, which is, of course, you know, a very cheap, low-budget way of dealing with the fact that this is a hellish beast that is, you know, not of this world. It is not just a monster that lives in the woods. this is a fucking demon, and reality alters around him. And I dig that, but we keep cutting back to that shot, and there's no lighting there. And then when he finally starts moving, we start getting some lighting effects in the background. And it's just one of those things that I don't think they noticed while they were shooting and then sat down with editing and like, well, nobody's going to notice this.
See, but that's a problem with the reverse shot. That is not a problem with the shot that I was outlining, which is still a perfect shot.
It's an amazing shot. Like, and it's yeah, and that's our first real, like, real good long, hey, oh, take a look at this. Like, we've gotten little bits and pieces of him. We've almost seen him completely. This is the shot where we're like, this is what Pumpkinhead looks like. This is our cover shot.
Digging into that eye feast right there.
Oh, yeah.
Delicious.
Why doesn't Daddy let the man in?
He can't, buddy. He just can't.
So this movie is about a man named Ed Harley, played by
Ed Harley,
played, of course, by
the fucking legend
Lance Henriksen. The problem I had with a character named Ed Harley in a movie where everyone has a southern accent, it sounded like they were saying Ed Hardy every 5 minutes. And I was just like, is Lance Henriksen going to show up in a really douchey t-shirt at some point? Like, really, with like gold chains.
No, he shows up with his shirt off and he's fucking ripped in this movie.
That's true. He definitely got in shape. And I love the fact that Lance Henriksen did some deep dive work to get into this character. He actually went out and found a bunch of silver dollars because he felt like this character would pay for everything in silver dollars. Like, he did a lot of things to kind of feel like, and that's what's great about Lance Henriksen. What I think we've talked about before in terms of Lance Henriksen is that every character he plays, no matter what the world that the character lives in, Lance Henriksen makes you feel like he has lived in that world for at least 20 years.
Yeah.
There's something very rooted about every single Lance Henriksen performance that makes you feel like he is a native of whatever world he's in.
Well, and it's also the fact that, you know, Lance lived life hard.
Yeah.
And a lot of that shows through. When you sit down and talk with him, it feels like you're talking with a Lance Henriksen character. Like, he's seen some shit.
Yeah.
And the shit that he's seen in his life is exactly what he brings to the fore in these roles.
Yes.
Like, he never feels like he's inhabiting a character. It always feels like he's inhabiting a world.
True.
And so, yeah, no. So Ed Harley, that is a backwoods guy. And what I love about Ed Harley is Ed Harley's a backwoods guy, but he's not a deep backwoods guy. Like, he's halfway between city folk and deep woods. And he's not, he's accepted by the mountain people, but he's not one of the mountain people.
Well, and I feel like that is Stan Winston's attempt to not patronize people of the South by making Lance Henriksen a character who is very intelligent, you immediately empathize with him. There is nothing so distant about him or so far removed from the world that, like, you and I live in, that you can't understand where he's coming from. You can't understand his motivations. And again, Lance Henriksen doing things like having dentures made so that he has more of a rural look, doing things like buying his own props and wardrobe for this character, finding his own World War II era pump action shotgun, and just really, like, again, inhabiting this world. That the fact that he is not the traditional stereotypical caricature of what a rural person is, or what someone from the Deep South or someone who is, like, really outside of civilization would be like, the audience therefore has more of an ability to go, oh yeah, I totally get this guy and I'm totally on his side, which is great, because shortly after we meet Ed Harley and his son, Jonathan Lipnicki, it's not Jonathan Lipnicki, just the kid reminded me every step of the way of fucking Jonathan Lipnicki.
Do you know the human head weighs 8 pounds?
Do you know the human pumpkin head weighs 22 pounds? All of a sudden, we have these X-gamers who show up, and they veer wildly off course and end up right smack dab in the middle of a John Steinbeck novel, which is where a lot of this movie takes place.
Oh, yeah. No, this movie, like, this is that part of the mountains that was in the 80s, still living in the 30s. They thought Walton's was a documentary.
or they would have if any of them had had a television.
By the way, oddly enough, did you recognize Mayim Bialik as one of the little girls?
Oh, no.
In the the beginning when they're dancing around singing the song about Pumpkinhead and talking about Pumpkinhead's going to get you, one of those little girls is Mayim Bialik.
I did think it was weird that the little girl was trying to tell me not to vaccinate my child, so I guess I should have put two and two together and realized that's who it was.
Ooh.
But I'm sorry, Mayim Bialik is a terrible human being. I look it up, guys. That's not an opinion. Fucking look it up. I would much rather root for the Steinbeck kids.
It actually is an opinion, but it's an opinion circling a fact.
It's an opinion backed up by these things called facts. Look them up. But yeah, so they end up there. All they want to do is ride their dirt bikes around. That's really all that they're looking for. And there's a situation where, you know, Ed Harley runs this fruit stand general store on the edge of the highway. And, you know, these kids are riding around. And his son,
who is the light of his life.
Oh, my God.
Like, you, for the opening of this movie is a father and son. And clearly this father loves this son more than fucking anything.
I'll take reasons Brian loves this movie more now than the first time he saw it for 500, Alex. Jesus Christ, does your heart bleed for Lance Henriksen and his relationship with his son, and how it makes it even more tragic when, and this is the thing I love about this movie, is that there is clearly someone who is totally in the wrong in this movie. There is a character who is a complete scumbag, but even he does not set out to hurt anyone. The circumstances around the death of this child, and narratively it makes total sense why this is true. The circumstances around the death of this child are not laden with clear fault. Like, it really is an accident. The kid is chasing his dog, trying to bring the dog back. The guy comes over the hill and doesn't see him. The villainous part doesn't even come until after he's killed this child accidentally and decides that because he's on probation, he needs to get the fuck out of there.
And he hasn't even killed the child at that point. The child's just injured.
Yes.
He just takes off because he's been drinking, and if he gets into trouble, he's done. They're going to yank his license. And he's a pro rider, so this is it. He's done.
So that's really his transgression. His transgression is not what happens with the kid. It's deciding that he can't stick around.
Yeah. But the thing is this is why I love the elegance of Pumpkinhead, because this douchebag, he's a douchebag, but he's not the bad guy of the movie.
No.
Ed Harley's the bad guy of the movie. Human nature is the bad guy of the movie. Like, it is Ed Harley, what he then does as a result of his son dying and these kids running off, is the villainous part. And he actually has the transgression. Even though this guy, the douchebag, has a mild transgression, there is an actual transgression in which Ed Harley then goes out to the mountain people and delivers this feed that he's got to deliver. And he goes, look, and the guy tries to give it pay for it. He's like, no, you keep that. I just want some information. There's a woman that lives out here in the woods. Folks say she got powers.
Yeah.
And he's, no, I don't know any woman. The guy keeps lying. He's clearly lying. He goes, look, there ain't nothing that woman can give you but send you to hell.
Now, did you notice who's playing that character, Mr. Wallace? It's George Buck Flower, who is a popular John Carpenter collaborator, is in Escape from New York, is in They Live.
Oh, shit, yes.
Yeah, he's a guy who always turns up in John Carpenter movies. You'll recognize in a second.
Yeah, God, I didn't even, like, I caught Mayim Bialik and I didn't catch that. There I go.
Congratulations.
Yeah, there it is. But
you're right, that's your monkey paw moment.
Yeah, and it's like, he tells him straight up. He tells him, he says, ain't nothing that woman can do for you but send you to hell. And so you have the son who's like, hey, I'll help you out, makes a little cash on the side, takes him out there, but won't take him all the way. Tip number two. If somebody says, yeah, I'll take you to the creepy witch of the woods, but I'm not going all the way out there. Also, a big red flag that you shouldn't
be
fucking
going. The biggest of red flags.
And so he goes anyway. He walks in. And then we get the beginning of something really cool that Stan Winston does with this movie. Stan Winston, there are two color palettes here in this movie, and they are amazing. They are a bright, fiery orange, and they are a rich blue.
Yeah.
And they are never together, so you never have the orange-blue thing.
It never has the color palette of modern movie posters.
Exactly.
Which is great.
But these rich, brown, orange palettes that Winston is painting with, so they're so rural and cozy. And he makes a witch's horror house kind of cozy in the way he does it.
But at the same time, going with the hell theme, it also looks like everything is on fire.
Yes, it is so well done. And the way they framed the witch to where you see her head and the hair coming off of it, and you're seeing the fire through the hair and seeing how thin her hair, like, it's just, it's so fucking cool. And it's such a fucking great fairy tale moment. I don't know that there is a witch in the woods reveal moment from any fairy tale or fantasy movie I've ever seen that is as evocative as the reveal of the witch in Pumpkinhead.
Yeah, and the design of the witch is the way that they shoot the witch, the way that she moves, she's almost like a Jim Henson creation. Like, there's just something,
except that she's real. Like,
she's very
again,
real.
Again, Stan Winston makeup effects.
Yeah.
Like, being creating something really creepy and authentic at the same time, where you're like, this is real, but I know that's not real, but I can't see the wires. I can't see, you know, the makeup. I only see this creepy witch. Like, this is, it's fantastic. And then, of course, she tells him the third warning, you don't want this.
Yeah.
And warns him against it. And he's like, I have to do this. And so after the third warning, he transgresses, he does the thing, and he is damned.
Oh, where's the witch live? I believe she lives up Faust Creek, right up there.
And since we're talking about her now, that great scene later when he comes back saying, I need you to stop it. I need you to stop this. And she's like, can't nothing be done. You know, you can't stop it. It's got to run its course.
And
he goes, God damn you. God damn you. And she starts laughing, goes, he already has.
Yeah.
And it's like, holy shit. And it's such a cool fucking just moment of, you know, just what this guy has done, and leads up to what is then a great finale. Of course, we have not explained that part of the plot. What does the witch give him? The witch allows him to unleash a demon called Pumpkinhead. She explains in a great little bit of mythology that I can't believe did not lead into a mess of sequels. Like, there are two sequels, technically three.
Yeah. There's like a couple, one or two that are made for the Sci-Fi Channel, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And
now, by the way, the second one, Blood Wings, stars Andrew, what is his last name? Andrew Stevens, the guy who is the father in Hellraiser, who's also the serial killer in Dirty Harry.
Yeah.
That we just talked about. He shows up in Blood Wings, Pumpkinhead 2.
See, the thing is what they explain about Pumpkinhead is there is a demon for each of man's deadly sins that embodies that sin. And Pumpkinhead is the spirit of vengeance, wrath. So,
wait, I thought Ghost Rider was the spirit of vengeance.
Technically, he's the.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
In the Marvel Universe.
I'm sorry, Ghost Rider is the spirit of out-of-focus movies. That's right, I forgot. I got my demons mixed up. Sorry about that.
Oh, are we going to have to argue about Ghost Rider 2 again?
Nope, do not argue with me on that movie. I will unleash Pumpkinhead on you. I will do it!
I have never in my life felt like you were going to punch me like the time I told you that I liked Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance.
I almost unleashed a demon of vengeance on you the moment you expressed your affinity for that movie.
Yeah.
It's okay to like movies, but I will send demons after you.
Yeah.
That's all I'm going to say.
But so what you can do is you make this pact and Pumpkinhead will come and get revenge on whatever, you know, whoever has wronged you. But there is a cost, and they don't really tell you the cost up front.
Consider, if you will, a demon living in a pumpkin. Like, we get it. Yeah, we shouldn't make this deal. Something bad is going to happen to us at the end. Thanks, Rod. You can go ahead and go now. Thank
you. So he has to, what he has to do, his actual transgression, he has to go out to this pumpkin patch and dig up this body that you'll know it when you find it. And that leads to the movie's best shot and what should be a centerpiece, but is so subtle that it's not something you really catch, that Ed Harley walks into the pumpkin patch and then we track along his feet, and we track through the entire pumpkin patch and pull back up into a crane shot to reveal this weird bit of ground sticking out of the earth where Pumpkinhead is buried, all in a single shot without an edit. And it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's
and
amazing.
It's one of those things that you watch from a technical aspect and you're like, that's a hard fucking shot, because you're doing that with smoke effects, and if until you've worked with smoke, you do not know how big of a pain in the ass smoke fucking is. One bit of wind and all of a sudden it looks like you're in a fucking hurricane. Like, it's unreal. We, like, when we shot Sinister, we made this mistake of having a smoke effect with children and a dog all in the same shoot, and we were pulling our hair out going, why did we do this? Why did we write this scene? This was the dumbest idea we've ever had.
Who wrote this scene? Unleash a demon on him.
And so here they're doing this this beautiful, you know, technically complicated shot that isn't, like, there's no soaring score. There's no big thing to where you just marvel at it. It's just invisible, but it's so well done. And so then he digs up Pumpkinhead and brings it back and unleashes the coolest fucking monster effect.
That's a thing.
What thing, man?
It's a thing. I don't know. It's a thing.
Let's talk about this monster and the amazing design of said monster, of titular monster Pumpkinhead. It looks like the best way I can describe Pumpkinhead is if you... what would happen if you evolved your Sam from Trick or Treat into, like, the third level Pokemon? That's Pumpkinhead.
If Sam from Trick or Treat fucked a Xenomorph.
Yeah.
That's what Pumpkinhead.
That offspring hit whatever.
And then Joss Whedon wrote an Aliens movie about it.
Sure.
And it said, Mama! And that is...
Fucking Joss Whedon did write Resurrection, didn't he?
Oh, yes, he did.
Remind me to...
That's why all the space pirate shit rocks.
Yeah.
The first hour of that movie where it's just space pirates is fucking cool.
Hey, remind me when we're done here to unleash a vengeance demon on Joss Whedon for making me sit through the latter half of Resurrection. Anyway, but it really does look like... it starts off looking like Sam from Trick or Treat, which I don't think is accidental. I'm sure that Mike Doherty is a fan of this movie. And then grows into this towering... gargoyle. Like, it is just, it's like Manute Bol auditioning for Gargoyles the movie. Like, this thing just fucking towers over everybody, and it's just, it's spindly, and it moves like it moves very balletically, you know, like very much like the actor who played the original Xenomorph. It's got that kind of flowing movement to it, and God, is it creepy. And not only is it creepy, something I forgot about this movie until I revisited it for the show, I forgot, we mentioned it's not gory, and that's true, but these kills are brutal. Brutal murders that happen in this movie.
And not gory.
Not
and
that's gory,
what's,
no.
That's what's so interesting about how they do it.
But Jason Voorhees, one swipe of that machete, and you're done, right? Like, or maybe he crushes your skull. That's the end of it. Pumpkinhead will drag you out of a cabin, like, throw you around the trees, pick you back up and slam you into the window just so your friends can see that you're suffering. And then he'll carve a cross into your head just to mock your religion. And then he'll drop you onto a rock so your spine shatters.
Interestingly enough, there are three different kills you described there. However, I want to talk about each of them individually.
But you understand what I'm saying. It's not a simple matter of swipe of the claw and it's dead. Like, he fucking toys with his victims because he's a demon of vengeance. I mean, goddammit, at one point... I mean, at the very beginning of this movie, and then it's echoed later, a man is being chased by Pumpkinhead, is trying to beat down the door of this cabin looking for help, and everyone in the holler knows about Pumpkinhead and refuses to help him. I mean, if that's not brutal in and of itself, I don't really know what is.
And it's for a movie that's so outlandish in its concept, in its fantasy, you know, in the first few... Friday the 13th, it's just a hillbilly in the woods killing people.
Yeah.
And that's it.
It could be Ed Harley for all we know.
Yeah. But here, this is a demon from fucking hell. And yet the realism of the deaths and how it goes about the deaths is kind of amazing. You talk about the one girl, she gets clawed. And, you know, she's in pain. He carves a cross on her face and she's in agony and she's kind of busted up, but she's alive until he puts her through a window.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, just going through a window, something that happens in every fucking movie and nothing ever happens. It's one of those, it's one of the laws of physics that Hollywood pretends to ignore. That, hey, by the way, if you go through a window, odds are you're not going to survive because here's how physics work and here's what broken glass fucking does to you. And she goes through that window and all of a sudden just it's blood gushing out of her. Like, and she just, she's dead right there.
Yeah.
Draining into the sink. And it's so creepy. And the other, you know, the other woman where he grabs her and climbs a fucking tree. Now, I wish they had a budget to show him climbing the fucking tree like that. They did not. So, you know.
Oh,
you,
don't worry, because the inevitable remake will do it with CG. Don't you worry about that. It'll happen. It will definitely happen.
Oh, well, I mean, somebody has the rights to it and has tried. I know that I got contacted about it years ago. That somebody came out of the woodwork and said, hey, would you be interested in doing a Pumpkinhead remake? But
don't show him climbing the tree with CG, and I won't have to unleash demons on
but
you.
So they drop her onto a rock and it's just like, yep. And it's, yep, like, oh, and it just hurts. And it's like, it's, that's what I think is so admirable about what Winston is doing here and why it's so classy, is he's doing a classic monster movie. He's doing the slasher movie model, but he's not succumbing to splatter. He's a makeup effects guy that could be doing the grossest shit we've ever seen, and instead he's trying to scare us legitimately.
Now, this movie does have arguably the best double-barrel shotgun impalement of 1988, and yes, there is competition for that because this was released the same year as Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers. So there's at least one other double-barrel shotgun impalement in 1988 for it to compete with. Yeah, I know, and it's a tough call.
When she gets impaled on that shotgun in Halloween 4, that's kind of a memorable fucking moment.
It is, but what might put Pumpkinhead over the top is not the fact that he arm wrestles for his son, but in fact, when he stabs the guy with the shotgun, he lifts it up. Like,
yeah,
man, you want to talk about a well-designed creature. Like, when you can pull off, and you don't see any wires, where you can pull off what looks like him supporting the entire weight of a human being at the end of a shotgun. Fuck yes.
Yeah.
This movie rules.
This movie really does. Like, and that's the thing, is one of the great things about having Stan Winston do this is you have a director that understands the limitations of practical effects and knows how to fucking shoot them perfectly. And so the last flaw this movie has is anything looking cheap or unreal.
Yeah.
Like, this movie sells that. And for it to be such a batshit insane monster, arguably the most batshit insane straight horror monster of the 80s.
Oh, for sure.
Like, there is, you know, in terms of, you know, science fiction, yeah, you've got some competition there. But in terms of, like, just horror monsters, no, this Pumpkinhead really takes the cake. In fact, that was the reason to watch Pumpkinhead back in the late 80s, was for the monster. Because, again, it was not, Stan Winston was not making a movie that audiences were looking for at the time. It's a movie that instead, here we are almost 30 years later, and it's like, oh yeah, you can still watch this as a very, very reliable movie. In fact, oddly enough, Fangoria is doing a 31 Nights of Horror, because of course they are, and they've got a different movie that they're watching every night that they're telling, hey, you sit down and watch this. And oddly enough, the night that I watched Pumpkinhead, I had no idea Fangoria had Pumpkinhead as their movie.
Nice.
I was like, oh, fucking great. That was perfect. So it is a movie that the class of it really, really stands the test of time.
It does not age.
And then we get to the end, and the end here, how this movie cinches up, is one of the best slasher film endings of all time. I say that unequivocally.
The graveyard, I want to know.
You know it, honey. You know.
I honestly believe that the, you know, most slasher film movies, most monster movies, have pretty much the similar ending. Hey, we've been given this tiny bit of information. Maybe it'll work. Oh, look, it worked.
And Vince gets to make the movie. Vince doesn't get to make the movie.
Here, our hero figures it out by our protagonist, shall I say. Hero's the wrong word. Our protagonist figures out what he's got to do, and what he's got to do is awful, and then he fucking does it. And he shoots himself in the fucking head. But he does that thing where he puts it to the side of his head instead of just putting it in his mouth and pointing out. So he doesn't actually kill himself. So he's lying on the ground and has to tell our final girl, hey, you got to kill me. At which point, the subtle irony of this movie, the little tiny joke that Stan Winston puts in, is she's like, okay, and shoots him repeatedly in the gut.
Yeah.
Like, does not just... clearly, he needs to die for this thing, for Pumpkinhead to die. And so she just kind of went, bam, bam. It's like, let him die. Let the man die. He's doing the noble thing. Why are you making him suffer?
It's like watching that scene in Torn Curtain where Paul Newman doesn't know how to fucking kill someone. And they're like, trying to kill the guy before the other guy gets in the house. And they try to stab him and the knife breaks. And they try to stick his head in the oven and the gas won't turn on. It's like, it's essentially the idea that movies make it look so easy to murder someone. And sometimes it's not at all. I was just like, this is farcical. And I kind of love it. I also love the fact that, you know, we were talking about how this feels like a fairy tale. Aiding that in no small way, of course, is the fact that this is based on a poem that actually gets recited a couple times during the movie. That begins with, keep away from Pumpkinhead unless you're tired of living. His enemies are mostly dead. He's mean and unforgiving. And just kind of go, it's very much your 1-2, Freddy's coming for you. But apparently that's the genesis of this entire movie, is that I believe his name was Justin. He writes this poem and Ed Justin was his name. And he writes this poem and they get a hold of it and they're like, let's make a movie around that. And Stan Winston's like, oh, I got a fucking monster we could put in this. And you take all of those elements, you take all of the pieces that form the genesis of this movie, and in anyone else's hands, I feel like this could have been incredibly schlocky. Incredibly.
Oh, imagine if this were a Charles Band movie.
I don't want to. I want to like it. But it's kind of, to me, like what you said before about, you know, the real advantage of having of a practical effects movie, so much writing on the practical effects, and the director is someone who understands those limitations, because you don't see that very often. You don't see someone who, you know, came from practical effects directing an entire movie.
By the way, something else that needs to be pointed out, as the movie goes on, Pumpkinhead's face changes. And it slowly changes into Lance Henriksen, which is so cool. So that final scene when he's dying and it's almost his face, and when they go and bury Pumpkinhead, there's that whole thing of they're not actually burying Pumpkinhead. Pumpkinhead actually catches on fire and burns in a great shot. And what they're burying is Ed Harley, who has become Pumpkinhead, and he will be Pumpkinhead next time. And it's like, that's so fucked up.
Yeah, and the visual like token of that, where you see the necklace that his little boy gave him around Pumpkinhead's neck, and it's just such a sweet... And this is kind of the metaphor I was building toward, was the idea of if a 5-course meal was made by a pastry chef. Every single course of that meal is going to have something glazed, is going to understand the full effect of the dessert. And when you get to dessert, holy fucking shit, is that going to be a dessert? And that's what this movie is. This movie is a 5-course meal crafted by a pastry chef, and it's all dessert. This entire movie is dessert, and every single course is done so fucking well that you can't even... This is not a B movie. This is not even a B movie. This is a sadly overlooked movie in a lot of ways. It doesn't
get the respect it deserves.
It doesn't get the respect it deserves, because I feel like there is whether you're a horror fan or not, there are certain titles that are regarded as classic no matter what your depth of affinity is for the genre of horror. Like Halloween is always going to be a classic to everyone, whether you like horror or not. This movie, I feel like, is of a similar pedigree in that it is a beautifully made movie from start to finish. Every element from top to bottom is perfectly executed, but it just doesn't have the same reputation. And I don't know if that's a product of coming out in the late 80s. I don't know if that's a product of people not taking Stan Winston seriously as a director. I don't know. I really don't know why that is, but I feel amongst horror fans, this absolutely has the reverence that it deserves, but it doesn't quite cross over the way some of the other titles do. And that's very disappointing. By the way, right before we get to the burning pumpkin head and Ed Harley, I keep wanting to say Ed Hardy, putting the gun to his own head, the teenagers try to steal a truck that apparently, from what I can tell, belongs to Kenny Loggins. Do you see this fucking actor? This fucking actor, dead ringer for the Log Dog. It was distracting me when he showed up. I
love that you slipped Log Dog in there.
The Log Dog apparently lives in Appalachia. I did not know that the highway to the danger zone ends in Appalachia. That is something I didn't know, and now I do. And I'm better for knowing that. But here's the thing.
It's Farm Road to the Danger Zone.
Farm Road to the Danger Zone. I will meet you halfway across that mountain ridge. The thing I kept thinking watching this, and tell me if you agree with this, Cargill. I'm sitting there watching this, and the movie this most reminded me of, the contemporary movie this most reminded me of, is Hatchet. I sat there watching this and thinking, you know, the first time I saw Hatchet, I thought, obviously, Adam is doing his own version of Friday the 13th with Victor Crowley. And then I started thinking about the story at the heart of Victor Crowley, the story about, you know, being in the backwoods and this loving father and, yeah, you know, really being about that relationship.
I know for a fact that that is part of the inspiration for this, because for Hatchet, because Hatchet was very much Adam's reaction to how silly and goofy slasher films got after 86, and Pumpkinhead is one of those that wasn't silly, and so I know that that was part of the genesis, and I'm sure, okay, and I'm sure Adam will speak about that at some point, because I'm going to have to ask him about the heavy influence of Pumpkinhead. But I remember him mentioning it like 10 years ago when we talked about it.
See,
he started mentioning, you know, at the very first screening at Fantastic Fest, he mentioned a couple of different movies, and I want to say Pumpkinhead was one of them.
I wasn't privy to that, but it was just, it was crazy to me watching this and thinking about how much this and Hatchet would make a great double feature, especially since Kane Hodder kind of gets to, in those flashback sequences, step into the role of Ed Harley and, you know, make a deal and conjure. And in the case of Hatchet, the demon of vengeance is Victor Crowley himself. But in this movie, it's this third party wraith that shows up to unleash all of this vengeance upon these teens. And yeah, I think it's a great morality play. I think it is timeless in that the seams still don't show to this day. I think it's definitely influenced contemporary movies. And I think we were cheated a little bit by not having more Stan Winston directed movies. I would have loved to seen what else we would have gotten if Stan Winston had gotten more opportunities.
I would love to have seen him do a movie about each of the seven deadly demons.
Fuck yes.
Like, I would have loved to see Stan Winston invent a different demon for each one of these, even if he didn't direct them, even if he just produced them. But to design these seven different demons and have these seven different, you know, morality tales.
Sure. And of course, the one for Sloth is just the Butterball Cenobite, right? Like, that's, again, headcanon. It all exists in the fucking Hellraiser universe. That's what we determined.
Oh, by the way, I pulled a boner. This was mentioned
right
to me.
Right now on the couch in front of me? I'm sending a demon!
No, I pulled a boner a few weeks ago when we talked about Hellraiser. I referred to one of the Cenobites as Chatterbox, which is how me and my friends always referred to him when we were younger. Apparently he's just the Chatterer, not Chatterbox.
Okay.
We were just calling him the wrong thing the whole time, and so I'm like, let me pull out this deep knowledge that I was fucking wrong on back in the day. So, so I've been wrong for 30 fucking years.
I want that soundbite pulled.
And you can thank Joe Lynch for that, who listened to the episode. He's like, dude, it's the Chatterer.
If you're going to get schooled by anybody, I guess it's appropriate that it's one of the hosts of
It's the Movie Crip!
I feel like we're going to have to end every episode doing that, and people are just going to be like, how much money are they paying Junk Food Cinema? The answer is nothing. Because we are terrible businessmen. So this week's Junk Food Pairing...
But nice people.
We're just nice people, as it turns out. I feel like this is so perfect for right now, because everything in the fucking world right now is pumpkin spice flavored. Everything. Everything from your lattes to your milkshakes to your potato chips to your fucking dress socks
and it's
are
fucking awesome.
It is. It's kind of amazing. It's kind of amazing. But in honor of this weird time of year when everything is, in fact, pumpkin spice, I kind of reworked the opening of that poem. So keep away from pumpkin bread, that spice all fall you're tasting. You reckon that's your streets ahead. Instead, you're awful basic. Because everything is fucking pumpkin spice right now, folks. Everything. You can't get away from it. Try it. You won't be able to. Like, I'm surprised that the only pumpkins left on Earth every year aren't the really mangled, gnarly ones in the Pumpkinhead pumpkin patch. That's what surprises me. You'd think they'd all be used up. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us on this episode where we paid tribute to one of the great underrated horror classics. Like, I don't understand why this movie isn't more highly regarded in the mainstream, but go back and watch it. I'm going to watch this every fucking year. Like, this is going to make it into my regular Halloween rotation.
It's a great Halloween movie. It is a perfect Halloween movie.
Absolutely. So, Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massawyrm, M-A-S-S-A-W-Y-R-M.
You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. We are at Junk Food Cinema on Twitter and facebook.com/JunkFoodCinema. And, of course, patreon.com/JunkFoodCinema, where for as little as $4 a month, you actually get access to bonus content that nobody else gets to hear. A lot of cool stuff there. We're really, really excited about it. All the bonus stuff we get to do for patrons, we genuinely love doing. So there's a lot of love that goes into those. And now is a great time to become a patron. That's all I'm going to say. And of course, buy Sea of Rust wherever you buy the books from. If we're still on a planet that allows you to read, I don't know what'll happen with nuclear war or whatever. But if you can still go to bookstores or you can still get books online, Sea of Rust. And until next time, I just want to remind you that it's Ed Harley, not Ed Hardy. Please take off that fucking shirt.